Well, here we're talking to Kevin Atkins, the MC, as it were, of Starfest, but so much more. Kevin, if Starfest were Tron, you would be the master control programmer, truly. It is such a thrill to have you talking to us today. My goodness, I guess the first question to throw out there, obviously, is how did you get involved in Starfest?
Well, I had just moved to Denver and was working over at the Gate Sanitarium at the former Denver Mausoleum of Unnatural Hysteria, and had seen a flyer on my boss's desk for the first convention. Back east at the Planetarium I'd worked for, we used to do a lot of science fiction films, and I had one of the people there would talk about the science aspect of the film, and then I would talk about special effects. So I had a rather long list of films that I had some, you know, background on. So I got a hold of Kathy, and we met, and I told her, I mean, if you'd like somebody to kind of help out, I could help you with the convention, and I'd be happy to do some talks on special effects and stuff. And she thought that was a great idea. So that's how I basically got started with it. As far as the emceeing goes, that was kind of an accident. We had the first convention just before the original Star Wars movie.
Wow.
And that summer, later that year, of course, Close Encounters of the Third Kind came out. And we had gotten involved through Columbia Pictures with Close Encounters at the Planetarium. We produced a show, a little 15-minute program that kind of told people how to report an accurate sighting for something that they didn't understand in the sky. And we then had Columbia Pictures paid for that, and they shifted around. We set up this whole free slideshow thing for planetariums to about 85 planetariums around the country and around the world. And it was a tie-in that planetarium could then do with the local theater that was going to be running Close Encounters. So that fall, we had a small one-evening sort of a star party that was sponsored by the museum and the planetarium, and I was kind of running that. So the following year, or the next year, which was StarCon, was originally StarCon was in the spring, and then we did one in the fall called Starfest. And so the next StarCon, the person that was supposed to MC for them, I believe his name was Ralph Albee, and he was involved with the Trivia Bowls here up at CU and stuff like that, and he was there for the first year. Well, they didn't have anybody, so I kind of got volunteered into the position, and so I've been doing the emceeing ever since then. And to me, it's nothing more than being a traffic director. In other words, I make sure the people, you know, find the stage, don't trip getting on and off, and kind of make sure people trying to get in for the next events kind of get to their seats and stuff like that. So it's just like a glorified traffic director. I don't get up there and read the laundry lists of the actors or actresses' accomplishments, because quite frankly, the people in the audience who are really interested in that person already know way more than anybody really needs to know. And to me, it's get them on so that people can talk to them, because that's what the guests want to meet with the folks in the audience, and vice versa. So the faster I get them on, the more time they have talking with their fans out there. They don't need to be listening to me bumping my gums any more than I have to.
It can get a little hairy out there. Like at times, I mean, it's as simple as you describe. And other times, I feel like I'm watching like Kevin Costner wrestle the buffalo in Dances with Wolves. Like at times, those audiences could be really, really difficult. I guess, but I think really what I really want to ask you rather is, in addition to your emceeing duties, you also host some panels about special effects. If you could tell us a little bit about that.
Well, again, I've always loved, that part of films. I mean, and so I kind of got started in dealing with some of the older films that hadn't been around for a while. I think we started, the first one we started that we really tore a film up, not really tore it apart, but reanalyzed it, was when Spielberg was going to redo War of the Worlds. And yeah. I thought it was an ideal time to bring up the original film and show exactly how advanced it was for the day. People nowadays are very jaded when it comes to film. They expect so much more, and they still don't really have a clue of how things are done. And I've always been more fascinated with the people behind the camera, because if it wasn't for them, all you've got is a bunch of, you know, people in makeup kind of bumping their gums. But it's all of those hundreds of people behind the scenes that are really accountable for what we see up there on the screen. And the better they do their craft, the more seamless all of that stuff is, and the more enjoyable the thing is for us out in the audience. So years ago, I used to kind of, it's sort of been every year, we just thought we would do some stuff. I got away from it for a while, but then once they started doing a lot of remakes, Day of the Earth, the War of the Worlds and such, I said, well, let's go back and look at stuff. And people like that. I mean, I don't fill up the room like a Summer Glau is going to fill up, but the people who do come to that, they seek me out afterwards, and we talk, and we have a good time talking about this kind of stuff. And then I can, if they're really interested, I can point them to magazines and books and places that they can get more information on that. And this year we're actually doing something a little bit different. I'm not really talking about special effects this year, so it's kind of a this year for me it's going to be like a little bit of a political statement on the status and statement about the lack of a space program. I don't know if very many people are aware, but the space station is just about complete. All the major components are in place. There's only 4 more missions, and then no more space shuttle flights. The government has basically pulled the plug on the program that was going to take us back to the moon. And what that means is, for those of you, for people who don't care about the space program at all, it doesn't matter, but we will no longer be a space-faring nation. There are actually no plans to put a manned spacecraft back into orbit. The only way we would be able to get to the space station is courtesy of the Russians. So the Russians will be providing the two-way transportation for the crews. The French have a module called Jules Verne, which is nothing more than a big robotic tin can that will be providing logistical support. But there is no plans for getting us, you know, ourselves back into space in any type of a manned vehicle in the near future.
And you're actually going to be showing stuff from the old Disney Tomorrowland stuff, right?
Yeah, it was interesting. Disney brought out these a series of the things a few years ago. There was the Tomorrowland one, and there was Fantasyland and everything else.
Are you talking about the Treasures series?
Yeah, and that was one of the first one to come out and go away was the Tomorrowland series. But now they brought it back out again. But what I find so fascinating about this whole thing is I'll be talking about kind of what led up to that. Walt Disney and the things that he was doing in the 50s, you know, remember, there were very few, you know, TV networks. So Disney basically was the Discovery Channel for the 50s, if you think about it. I mean, he did the True Life Adventures and things such as that. This is way before National Geographic and all of that. But even before that, there was a series of magazine articles. There was a weekly magazine called Collier's, and there was an interesting tale behind that. The people that were the publishers of Collier's magazine were at a meeting in New York, I believe, or Washington, one of the two places, that was had to do with something called space medicine. After World War II, you know, the V-2s and such, and dropping of the atom bomb and stuff, you know, we inherited a gentleman named Wernher von Braun from the Germans. He was their ace rocket scientist and was responsible for the V-2. He had a choice to make at the end of World War II, and that was, who do I surrender to? I mean, he pretty much knew the war was over, and he decided to surrender to the United States because he thought we were a much more religious nature, if you will, a much more moral nature nation than the Soviets were. So we lucked out there. Well, von Braun had always been a space dreamer, and he had actually written a science fiction novel about going to Mars, a manned Mars mission, that you can actually buy that now. It was actually officially released, I think, in 2006, and it's called Mission to Mars, a Technical Journal. It's a science fiction novel about going to Mars. He then took that, and that was written in 1949. 1952, he released a very, very technical book on how you would get there. Well, von Braun and some of his people were at this symposium on space medicine, which didn't really exist yet, but I'm just using that title. The Collier's magazine people were there as part of this and were so, you know, impressed by von Braun's love of space and his presentations that they put von Braun together and they got a team, of which one of the people was Chesley Bonestell, who is one of the very, very famous artists at the time, and who did a lot of matte paintings and stuff for like Destination Moon, When Worlds Collide, and things such as that. Well, this team of 6 or 7 people got together, and they did a series of articles in Collier's magazine, and those articles then led to 3 books, and Walt Disney saw the articles, Matt, and he was building Tomorrowland at the time at Disneyland, and thought this would be a great tie-in. So he spent an enormous amount of money, millions of dollars, to produce these 3 programs, which used animation, live action, to present von Braun's ideas of how we're going to get into space in the first place. Then we're going to, the next logical step is we come up with a reusable rocket. We then build a space station. From the space station, then we have a jumping off point to orbit the moon. then if we can also build a rocket then that leaves the space station and lands on the moon, then we'll build vehicles that will let us go to Mars and beyond. So that's what these three Walt Disney things are. One is called Man in Space, Man in the Moon, and Mars and Beyond. And they're very fascinating because a lot of the stuff in those three episodes and the stuff in the Collier's magazines have come true. So I'll be doing kind of an introduction showing some of the artwork and stuff from the original magazine articles and the original books, and then we'll run the three episodes. And each one of those was introduced by Leonard Maltin, who's a film historian. And so I've left those in there. I've left those in there because he provides some other insight to it, which was, since it was really well done, I didn't see any reason to cut that out. So then that leads us to, well, it's 2010, so we're going to run 2010.
Of course.
Sequel to 2001. We thought that'd be kind of fun. But Sunday, it was interesting, there was a BBC production called Voyage to the Planets and Beyond that aired on the Discovery Channel here, and it had to do with a manned version of the old Voyager Grand Tour. And it's like, how many planets can you visit? So, it's Venus, and then Mercury, got to Mars, and Jupiter, Saturn, and they eventually go out to Pluto. Well, the version that aired on the Discovery Channel here was missing 20 minutes, and I don't want to do spoilers, but they get to Saturn, and they go through the thing, and then they have a decision to make. Do we want to spend another 2 years going out to Pluto, or do we want to go home? So the Discovery Channel version has them going back to Earth after Saturn. Well, they brought it out on DVD not too long ago, and I didn't think too much about it until I started reading that there was a discrepancy between our version and the original BBC version. Fortunately, the DVD version has the rest of the mission that goes out to Pluto. So we're going to be running that on Sunday morning, and it's fascinating because it's a docudrama thing about, the type of ship you're going to need and everything else to do all of these things. Well, there was an interesting short-lived TV series on ABC this past fall called Defying Gravity.
Yes.
And Defying Gravity is loosely based upon the Voyage to the Planets. A lot of the people that were involved in that original production in England were involved in the design of the vehicles and the special effects and stuff for this Defying Gravity. Now, the problem with Defying Gravity is ABC was involved along with CTV in Canada, BBC in UK, and then another outfit in Germany. So you had these four major networks were putting this thing together. And, of course, ABC's track record was, well, most network television's track record with science fiction is pretty spotty.
Yeah, at best.
At best. And the main issue with Defying Gravity, it was a lot of flashbacks. And some people have to have their things pretty much A, B, C, D, E, F, and G, They don't know, they can't start at J and understand, well, I need to go back to B for a minute to explain, how this character got to be who he is. And so that was kind of confusing. Also, ABC started the series knowing they didn't have enough time to run all 13 episodes before the fall series. So that's some brilliant programming there, eh?
Wow, that's like they're with Fox, I'm just saying.
So I think four or five episodes were never aired in this country. Now, I'm sure if you did some searching, you could find a BitTorrent thing or something that had all of them. But they brought out the whole series, and so I picked it up and watched them. So what we're going to run on Sunday is The Voyage to the Planets, which is called Space Odyssey in England, followed by the pilot episode for Defying Gravity. And we've got enough time, so we're going to run the final episode, which would have been the cliffhanger for the particular cliffhanger for the first year's ending. And the Defying Gravity is one of the things where people looked at it and said, well, yeah, this is a little bit of, it's a little bit of a soap opera, and it's a little bit of this and it's a little bit of that. But it had a pretty interesting presence about what was really, there was something going on in the background that was actually the major, major motivation for doing this whole space tour thing. But what both of them have in common is the fact that, and Carl Sagan made this same comment years ago, is that space can't belong to any one nation. It's just, it costs too damn much money. And that's a reality. The space station, even though we built the majority of the parts, there's quite a lot of technology that did come from the rest of the participants in the ISS program that helped make the whole thing work. And if we're really going to have any kind of, Star Trek type future, the whole planet has to be behind it. It's just, you know, that's just the name of the game. You know, everybody has something to contribute. And, you know, the maybe so there's some guy in some small town in Germany that has the solution for, you know, a fusion drive or something like that. But we haven't heard of him yet. You know, space is just a real expensive thing, and we aren't going to, of course, get into, you know, how much wars cost as opposed to how much money we spend on space or, you know, welfare, all that kind of stuff, because that's a whole political nightmare that there's.
Yeah. You don't want to get into that at a sci-fi convention.
Yeah, no. So this year we're not doing special effects stuff, but I thought 2010 was a really good time to kind of say, and with the things that are happening for real, it's like, okay, this is basically, you know, maybe the way it should have been if things had gone a little bit differently, if we'd had a little bit more money to spend, or if we had a little bit more vision. So I'm off my soapbox now.
No, I really appreciate it, Kevin. I went to space camp, and for the first 12 years of my life, I wanted to be an astronaut. Before we get back to Starfest, I do want to ask you this question, because you'd be a very good person to ask. What do you think of all these, they've been coming up, these stories on the internet, and apparently they're becoming more common, these very expensive space tourism bits, where these millionaires pay good money to be shot out into outer space, or what is legally considered outer space, and brought back down. I mean, like, it seems like we hear less and less about NASA, but more about this niche, really crazy thing for newer rich people to do, to go say, I've been to outer space. What do you think of these things? Have you heard about that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, was it the you know, Spaceship 1 and 2? I mean, that's the whole idea, is to, you know, get folks up there and down. I think if you think back of the first docudrama, if you will, going to space, going to the moon, Destination Moon. I mean, even though NASA runs the programs, it's actually private industry that's doing the work. The problem is they're doing the work via handouts for the government. What NASA tends to do the best, I think, is to play the traffic director to a certain degree and get the people together. I mean, let's face it, if I won one of those Powerball things that got me $120 million, I would, you know, of course, they'd have to build a spaceship big enough to put me in, but I would take the $20 million, and basically, if we got $150 million and I walked home with 80 or 90 million of it after taxes, my wife and I would both be over in Star City as soon as you could get me on a plane. I would go in a heartbeat. But again, don't play the Powerball, so that's never going to happen.
You have to play it to win.
I don't think there's anything wrong with people spending the money, but I think what needs to happen is that once somebody realizes there is a bunch of money to be made by going to the moon or something like that, then private, you know, industry will get their butts in gear. The only thing I worry about that is not so much they would do it and get it there, but how many corners are they going to cut to do it? You know, are we going to have Toyota making spaceships that, you know, oh, we forgot the braking rocket, so I guess we won't be able to slow down to the moon.
Details.
Yeah. I don't think there's anything wrong with people trying to do that. I mean, because it makes people more aware of what's going on. Let's face it, for the average Joe, what's in it for me? Why should I be giving you tax money to plan for a mission that's not going to happen until 20 years down the road to go land on Mars? What's that got in for me when I don't know if I'm going to have a job in 2 weeks?
Yeah.
You know, so space has always been one of those things that's way, way, way down. And you can dig up all kinds of facts of the tons of things that we've gotten back from the space program, of how much for every dollar we put into it, I think somebody said we get $10 back. But a lot of that doesn't necessarily have a lot of, you know, doesn't mean much to the average guy on the street. You know, so the dreamers are, you know, we're always going to be out there doing that. But if we stop becoming a spacefaring nation, then we might as well just go back to the cave, because there's nothing left for us. You know, we're a country now that turns out more lawyers than engineers, and that's a pretty sad thing to think about.
That's depressing.
Yeah, and if you're an engineer, you almost have to go to India, or you have to go to Russia or England or something like that to work on a project. I mean, look at the big Hadron Collider. I mean, that's a multi-company or multi-country project that, you know, we're kind of on the outside of. But
Well, back to Starfest.
Something a little less depressing, please.
Well, a two-part question here. How does Starfest compare with some of the other conventions you've experienced over time? And who are some of your favorite guests have you seen over the last 30 years?
Oh, geez. Well, you know, we've been to a couple of the quote, big conventions. And, they're not the same. You have to keep in mind, at the time StarCon, StarFest first got started, there were dozens and dozens of little mom-and-pop conventions around the country. Also, there was not, you know, science fiction was still pretty much Star Trek. You know, Star Wars hadn't come out yet. But even after Star Wars came out, there were still a lot of, you know, people that you could get, you know, that wouldn't cost you an arm and both legs. But there were small conventions. I think we had less than 1,000 people at the first convention that we had here. And, you know, it wasn't so much people were in for it for the money. They were doing it because they figured, well, gee, if we can get enough people interested, all of us who have a common interest can meet this person. And that's what it started out to be. Eventually what happened is somebody somewhere who had pockets much deeper than the folks that run our convention have realized that there was a buck to be made, and a lot of bucks. And a lot of it has to do with, you know, like football players and, you know, sports celebrities. It's always, they've had these things where they bring somebody into town and, you know, they charge $50 for an autograph and the fans line up and do that. Well, as people started realizing that you could make a living out of this, this could become a business, then you have the Creation Cons, and now you got Dragon Con, and even Comic Con. I mean, look, that thing is just humongous now. It's actually out of control. It's no longer what it started out to be. It was a fan-based thing, but now it is the place because it's like a stone's throw from L.A. You have anything you want to promote, you go to, you got to go to Comic Con, and that's why you have all of these dozens of people that you know, like they had. A lot of folks have wanted us to get people from The Big Bang Theory, which is a hysterical show. It's very funny. The people are really good. The writers are really good. And we actually asked them, and we had the guy that plays Wallowitz had agreed to come to the convention, but then he got a gig that paid more bucks, and so he had to decline from that. I think the Creation Cons and the rest of those have kind of hurt us because they're not family-run. The people who run them, they come into town, you know, they find a big facility. The original Creation Cons were basically two rooms, a giant dealer's room and then a room where you got to see the guests. But even then, the guests were, okay, they put a table up on stage, and you have the group from Highlander, for example. Everybody from Highlander sits up there on the stage, and they spend more time clowning around with each other than they do interacting with the crowd. And as far as I'm concerned, if that's what you're going to do, you might as well just watch it on Letterman or something like that. You will very, very rarely find a convention where you can, where you as an audience are part of the convention. And let's face it, when, you know, you go up to that microphone to ask a question to that person on stage, you know, just like I say, everybody in that audience is just waiting to hear what you're going to say. But it's that interaction with the guests and the audience that makes our convention unique. I mean, there is something there for everybody. Sure, we can't, you know, we're not going to have Bill Shatner for 3 days, and we're not going to have, I was on this, the Wizards conventions at the Anaheim Convention Center. I mean, that convention center is huge.
Yeah.
Can you imagine us trying to run our convention down at the Denver Convention Center?
Oh, man.
Well, first of all, you couldn't afford it. But number two, it's like, do you really want to have that many people there? you know, wouldn't you rather have a wider variety of guests that kind of make things better for everybody? Hmm. One of the persons on the board said that she thought that the convention attendance has been down, and according to Steve and Kathy, no. Depending upon how you calculate the thing, but we've been running between, you know, 6,000 and 8,000 people a year for the whole weekend. And the thing that I like is when you have in the main events room, every single guest has a full house. To me, that's great. Rather, when you have a Shatner, sure, you get everybody in there, but you know, it's crowded and everything else, and a lot of times the Shatners and the Nimoys don't take a lot of time. The last time Shatner was here, I think he maybe took two, maybe three questions from the audience. The rest of it is just him up there, you know, pontificating and having a good time with himself up there. I would prefer to have it where we have a lot of different guests of maybe different interests, because the people that come to our conventions, they're pretty intelligent folk, and they come up with some pretty good questions. And, you know, they come up with questions to make the person on the stage think.
Yeah.
And maybe that's a bad thing, because there's a lot of guests that we've had who maybe don't feel real comfortable in a more one-to-one situation, which is what you are. When you're up on that stage, when you're talking to that person on the microphone, it's you and him or her. It's a pretty one-on-one type of a thing. And again, I don't try to censor anybody. I just say, you know, remember, everybody's hanging on your word, so you can ask whatever you want, you know, but you're open to either the wrath of the guests or the wrath of the rest of the people in the convention, because it's the attendees that really make the convention. when you think about it. So I don't know if that answers about the quote external conventions, and a lot of those won't come here. Kathy's always been worried that the two big warring factions out there, the Creation Cons and the other ones, would come into Denver. But the way I've always looked at it is, for them to do what they do would be a lot more expensive to do here. And let's face it, if I was going to go to a convention in Las Vegas, which some people have done, to me, Vegas is sort of a vacation place. So the convention would be kind of secondary to going to visit Las Vegas. Or if I'm going to an L.A. convention, I'm going to spend a week in L.A. and I'm going to go to Disneyland, I'm going to go to Universal and everything else. So the convention, to me, would not be my single destination to go to that. Whereas, to think that people are going to use Denver as a destination to go to Starfest, that's I don't think it's going to happen. Because I think 95% of the people that come to our convention are regulars.
Yeah.
You know, they save all year just to come to our convention because they know it's a place that they can go and meet. Like I put in one of my little rants on there is that a lot of the panels we have originated from folks who contacted Susan or Kathy and say, I have an idea for a panel. And they say, okay, we'll give you the space. You go for it. I mean, how many places would ever let you do that?
Exactly. I mean, heck, we're doing a podcasting panel this year. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's it. I mean, so there's some, and that's one of the bad things for me is I don't get a chance to get to some of these things. Because, I figure my job is to be in there and make sure things run as smoothly as I can, so I don't get a chance to. But just a number of different things in there that are available. The guys doing the model stuff have just gone, great guns and getting more and more things in there. And a friend of mine, Carolyn Peterson, she's a science writer. She and her husband own a company called Loch Ness Productions, and we're all old planetarium people. She's written several books on Hubble, and she's going to be giving a talk on the Hubble Space Telescope this year. We just have so much stuff that's run, really, the convention is pretty much run by the attendees because they come up with the ideas for the panels and such. The Horror Fest people have been having a good time. But our convention is a place where you go to once a year because you don't have any other place to go to meet these same people. And I don't ever want that to change.
Yeah.
So I don't want us to be a Creation Con or one of those other ones. I mean,
here,
I could
here.
Point.
Yep.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I just said here, here.
Yeah, we're agreeing with you over here.
So.
And Kevin, last question. I have to ask you this. Sometimes when there's a lull in between the different panels, you'll whip out your list of famously bad jokes. Where do you find these famously bad jokes that you manage to dazzle us with every year?
I have two friends that are my age or slightly older that are retired. So they have a lot more time to spend on the web than I do. And so... And quite frankly, 90% of what they send me is not usable in mixed company. but I depend on John Davis is a friend of mine. He's moved to Ohio now, and he hates it there, but he can't live in Colorado anymore because of his heart conditions. He can't deal with the altitude. And John Davis actually used to help me with the special effects talks and everything way, 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 way back when. And then Glenn Blair is another retired, he's a retired lawyer, as a matter of fact, who I met probably 10 years ago and when I was doing computer tech support. And so he's sort of like my grandfather. My grandfather passed away a long, long time ago. But if my grandfather were still alive, he'd be exactly like Glenn. So Glenn is the one that provides me with a lot of interesting things as well. You asked me about guests over the years. I have to say Patrick Stewart for one, because he impressed me. And this was, of course, the first time we had Patrick Stewart was before The Next Generation aired. He is the only the actor, and it was very, I felt very honored about this. We sat down and talked a bit before the convention and before he was on stage. He said, I want you on stage with me. I said, I want to make sure I have somebody else on that stage in case I get into trouble. And I thought, oh, my God, this guy's, what am I going to do? But what impressed me the most was the fact he worked that stage without a microphone.
Wow.
And there was nobody in the audience that didn't hear him.
Dang.
And I had to laugh after we were over because we were all sitting down having some coffee. And I said, I'll bet you the sound people on the set just hate you. And he just broke up and he said, yeah, you're absolutely right. Because he just, once he's into character, he's just used to being on the stage.
Hmm.
And, so being able to be on stage with Patrick, I could have just stood there, and slept. But I was there just to kind of, point things around. But it was just delightful for him because he was such a down-to-earth guy. Other people, that's really tough. Another one that really comes to mind as being a heck of a nice guy is Colin Meaney. Now, you know, he was on DS9 and everything. But he was one of these guys, and of course, that was another of these guys that was as interested in what we all did when we'd sit around. Because he was one of those guys that you could walk him up to the bar and buy him a beer, or he'd buy you a beer. He was one of those kind of guys. And, of course, George Takei. George has always been a delightful person. In the olden days, when he had more time, he's always been a busy person. He would come into town a day early, and he and I would get together and go look at historical buildings.
Cool.
He worked for the Preservation District out there in L.A. And so it was always fun with him. And then whenever we went to L.A., you know, you'd call him up, and we'd all meet over at Paramount. We'd go to lunch, and, you know, we'd get the tour of whatever was going on and stuff. But he was known as these guys who would always have a good time with us and was just a delightful guy. And so I was so glad to have him back. And so we Carol and I got our pictures taken with him. And, you know, so he's one that's always been willing to do everything he could. He would always come to the staff party on Sunday night and, you know, have pizza with us and everything.
Wow.
He was just a great guy. He still is such a great guy. So
that's awesome. Well, right. Kevin, thank you so much for your time. Congratulations on, if my calculations are right, 33 years of you doing this, which means you've been doing this as long as I've been alive, which is very cool. Congratulations, and I can't wait to see what you do this year, and Starfest is going to be fantastic this year. I hope all of our listeners go and check it out. Kevin Atkins, MC, Grand Overseer of Starfest, thank you so much for talking with us this morning.
Well, thanks for considering having me on here.